visuals gets to your brain 10,000 times faster than words. So they already in your brain, but you just don't realize it. So you think, oh my God, I must be thinner. They're very clever visuals because they get to your brain fast. That's why advertisers love them. You need to be aware of the intention. It's a $1 billion industry to make you feel crap. And actually, this is the most clever thing because it's the most unattainable thing to be thin at all times. So the more something is unattainable, the more profitable it will be. The generation of our kids need to look at even more visuals, training them that how to look at images, how visuals are affecting them, and therefore to put distance with them. That is not truthful at all times, especially in the rise of deepfake, for instance. It's not at all times something that they should digest.
Do you think AI is destroying creatives and creativity? Quick question. When did you discover that you're a leader? That your actions matter to those that look up to you? You may be an entrepreneur or an aspiring entrepreneur, innovating to change the world, or a CEO navigating a crisis, or a parent returning to work and learning to lead your career, your team, your children. There are many faces of leadership, and this is the podcast to explore them all. Welcome to Anatomy of a Leader with me, Maria Vorostovsky. I'm a headhunter and founder of HVO Search, where I help ambitious leaders hire their executive teams. My job today on this show is to help you discover your superpowers, to help you avoid making some of the same mistakes, and to remind you that even if you do, perfection doesn't and shouldn't exist. Thank you so much for listening, and please do subscribe and follow this podcast because it really helps others to discover these incredible stories. This show will challenge the way you think and may even change your life. Maureen, welcome to Anatomy of a Leader. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's such a pleasure. I've been reading about your business, Empty Art, and I'm so fascinated and really impressed with what you have achieved with the business.
Oh, but thank you.
Before we get into it, for those people who may know who you are, can you introduce yourself?
It's always hard, isn't it, to do an introduction in a very short time. I'm the lucky CEO and founder of Empty Art Agency. So we are the art sector's leading talent agency. What that means in short is you build the reputation of the artists that you love, make sure that they get to the top, but also you integrate their art across all different types of contexts, from public art to brand partnership to digital to fine art institution. And it's a pure joy to see, you know, millions of people that will get exposed to the arts, from walking up to Regent Street. We kicked off the World Cup with public art. We have the National Portrait Gallery that's got the works of our artists, etc. So it's the sheer joy of seeing people who are talented succeed. And the second one is to have people who are inspired by the art on a constant basis. I think it probably captures who I am as a person, where I love to support talent. I get really excited to see ambitious, driven people succeed. And I have a lot of admiration for resilience as well, and someone who's, you know, has that inspiration and that vision. And secondly, I enjoy the act of creating magic, where someone is looking at something that's, you know, artistically touching or emotional or conceptual, or like, and just stopping for a few seconds and engaging with this. And so I think as a person, that's probably the two things I care most about.
So where did the passion for art come from for you?
So I actually grew up in a place where there's no art whatsoever, but there is, it's very visually beautiful. So I'm sure that informed the need at least to have a visual environment that is inspiring. It's called Île-de-Ré, which is a French island on the west coast of France. And I spent 17 years there. I always joke that there's more birds than people there, so there's not much happening on a regular basis. And it's just, you know, you're going off to school, then there's a bus to go to the mainland for high school because you don't have a high school hostel on site. But you're surrounded by the sea, the fields. I love cycling there. So you are, I guess, immersed into an environment where visually you'll be very inspired by it. So I think that probably develops a sensitivity towards the need of having a visual environment that I felt really inspired. I'm incredibly sensitive to visual environments and the wish to kind of design them, shape them, influence them, inspire the people with visual environments. And I think artists came from books that I read. I'm a big reader. I read a book a week, and I've always read loads. It was my parents always had to tell me off from not reading too late at night. Which I know sounds weird that they would tell me off, but actually they were finding that annoying that I was staying up late so long. But I feel from books, it was always the characters. I just love the strong, inspiring characters, which I find a lot in the artists at work today, where they are people who have defied the odds, who've gone through an incredible life, who have a very powerful story to tell. And I think that comes probably from that joy of just reading books where you feel that character is just so deeply inspiring. That's the relationship I developed with characters and therefore artists early on. And I think the visual environment is just a luck of being born in a place where it's very visually beautiful.
Mm. You know, when you're talking about your parents telling you off for reading, like, I mean, my mom was like that. I mean, I read, and I probably used to read a lot more back when I was younger than now. But my sister's like just completely obsessed. And when she even will like have a book while she's eating her dinner or lunch, and it's like literally just like surgically attached to a book.
I quote books regularly all day long, and I'm always seen, like I have one in my basket on my way to kind of come and see you. They are shaping my brain. I think it's just they teach you to think differently about ideas. You have to immerse yourself into worlds that are not yours. And ultimately, I think my empathy, my levels of understanding the world, but also my relationship with myself is constantly developing as a result of reading. Mm-hmm. I'm now lucky that a lot of the people that I love around me actually also publish books. So it's also quite interesting to kind of be able to read the books and then discuss with the author. And I think that's such a luxury of trying to comprehend how those books are made in the first place. But they are a very important part of my life. And they occupy a lot of my conversations daily.
No, I totally get that about talking to the authors who have written books, because on the show, that's one of my favorite things as well. It's like, you know, reading something most of the time is management or business.
Yeah.
And then talking to the author about it and just like really getting under the skin and understanding where the concepts and the ideas come from. Because I mean, when you're reading a book, you're spending quite a significant period of time with that person.
Totally.
Getting into their way of thinking and, you know, listening to their arguments. I mean, depending on what the book is about, whether it's a novel or, some sort of an argument about how to improve your life and whatnot. So, you know, growing up in a very beautiful environment, spending a lot of time reading books, when did the idea to found Empty Art come from?
I was always very romantic. I think something, again, probably coming from a good visual environment, or at least good, at least something that a visual environment I found inspiring myself. I just felt I had capacity to visualize things, and I think visualize ultimately the life I wanted and the things I would want to do. As a romantic, I feel I wanted that life surrounded by creatives. I wanted a workplace that was like this, and I wanted projects or at least some form of job that was to do with them. I couldn't shape it any better because obviously it didn't exist on the island. But I did write exactly that vision at 19 when applying to an internship at BBC. I wrote that I wanted the arts to kind of collaborate better with each other and ultimately to impact audiences at a larger scale. Because it was very much that kind of visual environment immersion that I was looking for. And I wanted to almost design. And I got accepted. And I thought that was incredible. People were paid to do something so interesting. I could literally do it eyes closed, including weekends, without thinking, because I thought, well, what Andrew Graham Dixon does for the Culture Assurers was so interesting. He just reads books, talks about them, and, you know, meets creatives. I was like, if jobs like this exist, then I have to find myself how to get one of those jobs, because that sounds like I would never work a day in my life again. And I was approached by someone who discovered Banksy, called Steve Lazaridis, who built a very successful business called Lazaridis and discovered Main Street artists. Because I was chatting to everyone, I was finding really interesting. I think we had that conversation before the podcast on your love for asking questions, but I generally was very curious about the way the sector was put together. I was offered quite a few opportunities very young, thanks to that. And then the one that stuck was being the gallery manager for Steve Lazaridis, managed his gallery in Soho. Street artists were completely remote to what I would know normally, because again, I was more on the poetry romantic side. I think they opened up a world for me of how do you create social and political impacts ultimately through putting art on the streets. And I feel that opened up my brain again on thinking, I really like that. I like the fact that ultimately people are thinking differently thanks to the art that they encounter on the streets. And I was lucky again to have an investor walking into my gallery 2 years from that. So I'm now 23. And saying, I would like to open a gallery with someone in Los Angeles. I was in London at the time, and he would want to invest in that person building the business up. I said yes. And went to Los Angeles, built the gallery. And through building the galleries, discovered all the top talent agencies in Los Angeles. And I feel the relationship that a talent agency has with its talents, which is ultimately backing them, constructing the entire business around them, more than a gallery that for me feels more like a retail store. And a space. So the relationship is more with the space and the objects than with the talent. Just inspired me. And I felt that the art world doesn't have a talent agency. All the talent agencies I see in music, film, and sports are super inspiring. I would like to build that business. And so at 25, I went back, started building it, put all the values I thought were most dear to me, all the problems I couldn't solve in the sector, such as making sure that there was more revenues for artists earlier, making sure that audiences at large could be reached because we're in a sector where we don't really do that. So I lined up my kind of dream plan on what that vision will be. And I think being 25 does allow you to be very idealistic about things. But one thing I'm very, very grateful for is actually that vision happened, but also we never diverted from that vision and those values. And those values are created by a very idealistic 25 years old. And I'm so glad that they were not created by a cynical older adult who would have probably thought, that's not possible, let's not put that in, or those values sound like, you know, too idealistic. So I'm super pleased that this is not hasn't been the case. I'm very grateful for 25 years old, and I have a really good relationship with that 25 years old for that reason. I'm glad I'm now an elder adult who can execute things. I think the dynamic works both ways. But yeah, we're lucky it worked out. We're now, it feels crazy to be the number one. It felt crazy to be one of the fastest growing company in the country, according to the Times. Lots has happened, but I feel the passion is still there and exactly the same. The values are still the same. And I think it's amazing that the team onboarded onto those values. I feel it's, you know, it was my birthday last week, not to say happy birthday, but more to say, I said to my team, I don't want anything material, but I would want to understand the relationship you have with the company. That would be the best birthday present for me. And I think it's just like, it's just, you know, they came up with words of reflection that I could not come up myself. And I think that is amazing to see that the vision is evolving in the hands of a team of partners, of clients, of talents, who care a lot about it, and going beyond you, which I think is really, I'm really grateful for.
I'll come back to that, the going beyond you, but I'd like to go back in time again to, you know, you being 25,
yeah,
and the mindset that you had. Tell me how you were feeling at that time, because sometimes when you're starting a business, it comes from either a necessity, or you're like, oh, this hasn't been done, or, oh, it's really scary, but you know what, I'm just going to do it anyway. So what were you feeling at that time?
I think I had all the feels of a 25 years old, where ultimately, I mean, I can't generalize, but you know, you're very intense about everything, and everything that happens is felt intensely. Everything is overly dramatized because it's just the nature of the age. But again, I would not have it any other way. And so, you know, for me, it was a matter of, this is it. I'm either building that or not doing anything. It was very dramatic in a very black and white radical way that you can be in that age. But that radicality meant that I didn't want to take another job. I preferred to struggle and financially and build the business I wanted and do all these things that I think the lack of radicality will probably have made very different. So, but it was very black and white. It was, I want this and I want that to happen. And I want to build it. And there's no other option, and I don't want to hear about plan B or plan C or plan D, right? It's a radicality of being in your 20s, which I love. I've always said I have loved every single of my age, and I hope it continues, because you see how different you are with every phase of life, you know, and that phase was radical. I wanted to change things. I was not afraid to say it. I was not afraid to say most of my views. And I was just probably not thinking much of the consequences, because you're just so passionate about what you want to build. And I think that enables you to build something that's bolder than, you know, I mean, an age where you think consequences much more for obvious reasons, that it impacts your team and what you've built a lot more. So you're not able to take as much risk. You take risk because I want to keep risk taking at the heart of the business, but you will definitely not take radical risk in the same way once you are managing people, because the responsibilities have shifted. So it's a beautiful age for this. I feel 20s are very beautiful for that, but they are tough. Like, they are intense years. They're not like, it's not like you lie there being like, I'm so happy to be in that phase. But lived intensely, I think they are wonderful. They're a wonderful decade of just the experiment, the black and white ideas, the need for change, the wish for change, and the how idealistic you are about it, that I think has a true value to society and a true value when building a business as well.
I mean, what you're saying is actually there's a lot of confidence there. And I'm not sure every 25-year-old is the same.
So yeah, of course, yeah, totally.
Where do you think your confidence comes from?
I do think it's a confidence in the sense that I don't look at myself in the mirror. I was laughing this weekend because my 4-year-old looked at himself in the mirror and clearly adored what he was seeing, which was the cutest thing to watch. But I definitely wouldn't have that look at myself in the mirror thinking I'm wonderful. It's more, I am able to act even when the situation is complex or when there's doubts or when there's anxiety, when there's also feeling. I'm a very action-driven person. I think I have cheated a bit philosophically, but one of the philosophy in my 20s was more a Sartre, where it's existentialist. You know, every action defines you. I think I'm more of an in-between at this stage. I would be more on the Buddhism, where you're just much more emotions mixed with actions and you've grown a bit more, because I think your vulnerability and your empathy is growing with age as well. But I think at that time it's very action-driven. So it doesn't mean you're confident. It means you are just... you just do one action after another and you have the capacity to action things. And I think that's more what my strength is. I can act even when things are difficult. Even when it's a bit scary to act, I will still be able to act. And I think that's a strength, I think, in the context of being an entrepreneur.
So what has given you this confidence to be able to act even when things are difficult?
I feel like, you know, you never wake up with confidence. It's a muscle. I believe that everything is a muscle, whether it's like your social skills, imagination, your visual sense, your resilience, all the things are muscles that you built up over time. So I do believe you ever wake up being like, tadam, I'm like resilient now. But I do feel it gets better. And obviously the more risk you take, the more comfortable you are with being uncomfortable, and all those things just unfold to be now 15 years later, when I'm very comfortable being uncomfortable in a situation and not knowing about something and acquiring knowledge for this. But I feel, therefore, that it's been now since 17 that I look after myself financially and life-wise, knowing about where my parents are both primary teachers, but they just not able to kind of contribute to the financial needs of universities or what I'm now doing business-wise. So I think with financial independence so early on, you do have a sense, I think probably of that where you mentioned confidence, where, you know, every action, you pick up the consequences of it and you comprehend ultimately what the actions are going to do. Mm-hmm. But also you just I've been shaping my life for a very long time as a person and since very young. So I feel like it's, you get better at it. Year on year, and you take better at understanding what's right for you, what's not. It doesn't mean tons of people haven't helped me, but it just means, you know, it's been since 17 that ultimately the bills are paid by me, and my understanding of that is by me. So therefore, I comprehend how to go about things and how difficult things will be or not. And I think the economical empowerment probably plays a part in that.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that financial independence was a drive for you?
I do think it was a drive, but I think having to earn money probably changes how you would go about life for sure, because ultimately you can't make the same decisions, but it also means that like the way you would act will be different. So for me, financial has never been the drive, but there are an understanding that there's no option. Mm-hmm. Like, so by understanding that it's there and you're having to, you know, respond to it, mm-hmm. probably makes you a very different person than if there was a net or a safety net, right? But no, I feel like also having looked after myself since a young age, I don't find financial scary. I don't think, like, because you just, you get used to it. You get used to being the person that provides. So you also don't think this is something kind of unattainable as a goal that you must attain. It's for something that's part of life that you know you have to ultimately look after.
Mm. Talking about finances, I mean, I'll share my own personal story about, I used to paint all the time. And, you know, my parents were like, oh, she's really good at that. Let's sort of support that, her, and push her into it. And ultimately, I decided not to pursue it because it seemed like a very unsure path. Because, you know, you kind of see artists who are either struggling or very few really make it to, you know, the top echelons. And so picking a path that was a little bit more sure, a little bit more proven, or at least, you know, you know, whatever you put in, whatever you get out. So this financial aspect that puts, I'm sure, a lot of people off pursuing art as a career. And I love what you're doing with Empty Art, of democratizing that and also supporting artists. Can you talk more about that, what you're doing with your business?
So we contribute to the studio cost of our artists monthly, and we make sure that they have opportunities much earlier. So I think while finance are not the drive, I feel ideas and people being able to realize the ideas is the drive. Now, finance will be a component of it, because I believe that knowing the right people and having the right contacts will also be another component, and the many inequalities that you could have in the matter of it. So finance being one component of it, for us, it was important to be able to provide it. I'm very passionate about having diversity of talents. So ultimately, who gets to inspire you artistically, for me, must be diverse. And for that to happen, you need, like you say, to make sure that all social economics align for everyone to be able to produce art, because otherwise you just only get to be inspired by a type of people. And that's my big problem with the sector. There's a great book that you would like called Culture is Bad for You. Mm-hmm. And it sadly lays out all the inequalities. I think it's probably the first book you read thinking, shit, there's a lot of problems. I would like to think I'm like the solution person. So I would hope to be refreshing after the book. But that, you know, like, I will give a few examples from our artists, but Raven D. Clark, who comes from a working class background, just got a $2 million deal 6 months ago for 3 public art sculptures in Alabama in the US. The sculptures will be on slavery, so it's also shaping historically, they'll be permanent, a topic that's essential. Plus, at her age, she's able to take a mortgage. And if you think that 97% of sculptures you see on the streets are by white men, I think that's like incredible. Like, her, not only is her empowerment happening artistically, but also financially. So I love that. I love that kind of examples. I like to strive for deals like this, because a Raven will be able to inspire many in the making. And there will be girls I cannot inspire because I cannot be their role model, but she'll be their role model. And that's the importance of having a diversity of role models per se. So I think we always believe in the value of opportunities. We've never accepted opportunities that didn't pay artists. We just believe in the way to be fairly paid. And it's hard that you get into argument for that, because people will be like, it's great exposure for the artists and all of this reasoning to why this should be done. So it's ironic, as an entrepreneur, you know, I will be doing interviews or loads of things non-paid happily, because I would understand this is marketing for the company. But actually, for our artists, we'll always make sure that there's a fairly paid opportunity behind it. And that runs deep in the values of the company. And again, it's to make sure that finance actually is not a problem, because if finance is better equalized and you don't think about it anymore, you just see talent. But obviously, if you don't attend to it, or you know, make sure that you look after the financial disparities, then you actually, finance becomes a problem. So specifically, because I don't want to speak about finance, I want to speak about their talent, that I wanted to address the financial issues and inequalities that the sector was facing. So it's a joy to get there. It's so many of those examples are just so fulfilling on a daily basis. But it's a joy to kind of sign those deals for that reason.
Mm. How do you select your artists?
So we have a selection committee. And we get about 200 applications a month. So we get a lot of applications. I'm sure it's now more, but because we haven't measured it, I don't want to tell a number that's wrong, but it's actually, I've been saying the same number for a little while now, and I'm pretty sure it's more. But we look at people who have this very unique voice, from the style and how it's adding value to the medium that they're using, or the medium's plural, up to conceptually how they position, like what story do they tell that adds value ultimately to the artistic context we're in. So to give you an example, like one of our artists that I empower is using AI in her work and music as well. And she's looking at the way in which we connect to landscape. And she's making this very imaginative, but imaginative, beautiful landscape that you almost can't touch or relate to kind of show our relationship with a lot of the images that we take, especially on social media, just not connecting to the landscape we are, just seeing them as a background, almost like a Windows countryside background, which is a background to put your files on, but you're not actually connecting with it. So each of them will have almost a topic or way to look at the world that's very unique and they would have dive into. And it's a joy again, because you just are lucky in that job to be constantly learning about ways to look at the world.
We live in a world now full of technology and access to visuals every second of the day. I mean, I don't know what the latest statistics are about just how much we are exposed to on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And imagery is everything. So we're going from, you know, you growing up in France and seeing beautiful landscapes to sitting in front of a screen and, you know, Instagram and social media bombarding us with images. And I've watched one of your TED Talks about this idea of, you know, you have to be careful about what you feed your eyes and how much that influences us. And that really stuck with me, because it's true, what we choose to consume impacts us. So I guess the question is, what kind of imagery is good for our health and what kind of imagery is not?
So I feel this is a complex question. Did you read the book Process People that just came out of Penguin? So there's a book that came out about, sadly, the processed food impact that we are digesting. It's quite a scary book to read, it sparked a lot of conversation for the past few weeks, because the snacking industry is worth $700 billion, and it's actually on a 5% increase year on year. And I feel, for me, visual junk is kind of a similar. I'm about to publish a book on the exact topic of the TED Talk. So actually the TED Talk inspired Penguin to approach me to publish a book, and that's coming up on the 7th of March. But we've gone slightly away from food. The reason why is because, exactly like you said, we don't want to fall into the good and bad. What I want to fall onto is your awareness that you're consuming loads of visuals, because you know you're consuming food because you're going to the loo after, or you're just getting energy and you are aware of your digestive system. Well, I would hope you are, right? But actually, you're not aware as much that you're consuming visuals. So for me, it's more about the awareness that you're interacting with those visuals and those visuals affect you, more than trying to classify good and bad. Now, there is a caveat to add to this in the light of the Process People book, is that I do think there are visuals in repetition that will make you feel very insecure, more to consume probably something that's not very great for you and probably shape you in a way that's not ideal, right? My problem with good and bad is that I don't want someone to feel shit and to start having guilt, because ultimately that's also what's happening with food. Our thing is, how do we make sure that you have awareness for food, but you don't feel guilty every 2 seconds? And that's a lot of what that book is about, because I don't want some people to start thinking, crap, I was feeling guilty with food and now Marines made me feel guilty with visuals. That is not at all the feeling I want to give you. The feeling I want to give you is, actually, did you realize that in just a single day, you look at 1,000 visuals? Do you even realize that? And actually, you are in discussion with them in the same way that if suddenly someone on the street was coming up to you and shouting at you, you'll think, oh gosh, I have to tell that story. Someone just randomly walked to me and shouted at me. But actually, visuals do this all the time. You have those visuals that aggress you and would impact your brain emotionally. They would trigger you, but you're not aware of that. You probably just bypass it without thinking that was a trigger. Whereas actually, when it's a word and someone shouts that word at you, you are aware of that trigger. So for me, the key thing is awareness. Second key thing is that through that awareness that you curate your diet. Once again, it's the same with food for me. If you want to eat tons of junk food, I am not here for you to tell you you shouldn't. But I think you should be aware. It's all about information, that game of making sure you are knowledgeable about what you are typically looking at and consuming. I think in visuals, it's the same. You know, if for me, it's not just social media that would make you feel insecure. It's and everyone always puts a conversation on social media, but actually, no, it's advertising on the billboards, it's magazines, it's social media. I mean, magazines have been making us feel crap as women for like, you know, decades. They haven't waited for social media and that bikini picture of that woman to make us feel crap. And I think it's a bit too easy to say we're addicted to technology. Of course, there's separate issues of technology, but actually there's a visual content we're constantly being bombarded with for so many decades that comes out of the advertising sector, the political sector that is feeding us. Mm-hmm. Now, again, it's for us to be thinking, hold on, I feel crap about my body, or I feel crap about wanting to be someone or consume something because maybe I've seen hundreds of visuals for the past 3 days that reinforces. And that enables you to put distance with that thought, because otherwise, you know, the visuals get to your brain 10,000 times faster than words. So they already in your brain, but you just don't realize it. So you think, oh my God, I must be thinner. But actually, how helpful would it be that you think, hold on, I'm being told to be thinner, more that I must be thinner. And that's, again, they're very clever visuals because they get to your brain fast. You don't comprehend they got to your brain. You have very little awareness. You've actually consumed all that content. And then you go and act. And of course, that's why advertisers love them, because they get to you really quickly, but you're not even aware this is through them that actually you're starting feeding off those desires, those wishes, and those insecurities. So the key thing is really awareness, more than good and bad. And after this, it is up to you to make decisions. But I want you to be knowledgeable and aware.
Mm. We are being bombarded with visuals. Someone's creating these on purpose.
Yeah.
So it's also the intention behind it. Like, what triggers are they trying to elicit in you? And that goes much deeper than just, like, well, I've saw this picture of this girl in a bikini and now I feel, you know, an hour later, you know, I'm, I don't know, snacking on Doritos because it made me feel bad that I will never be that way or whatever. But it's the intention behind these images that also is a danger. What must we do to avoid it?
I think intention, you cannot avoid it purely because we are in a belief society. So all of us have belief system. If you think the people who use most images to start with were religion, right? The Christian church in the 15th century started telling stories of how you should behave, how Marie's behaving, how Jesus Christ is behaving through visuals, right? So I think being in a society of belief, you would always have people who have different belief, and that's fine. Like, there's nothing you can do about this. This is, we are made to judge and believe constantly because that's our way to survive. We adapt to the world through belief system. What you said is true on, we need to be aware of the intention. So when you are reading a paper that is right wing and is talking about immigration, you know that their views on immigration is going to be X way. And that's fine, because again, if you're right wing, you can embrace that. But if you're not, then at least you know the viewpoint on that problem is a way, right? If you're watching Fox News versus BBC News, you know your viewpoint are going to change. The problem is we haven't been taught to do the same with visuals. And going back to intention, there's nothing wrong with having intentions. We will, as belief people, we would always try to push belief system onto other people. We think our way to approach life is obviously the best, right? And you see it, I'm sure, with motherhood nonstop, where everyone thinks they're the best parents ever, right? And this is a way to do things. So that you can't change, but you can change that you can't bring the intention of what's being pushed as a visual. So if, you know, let's go back to the bikini picture. You can, for instance, relate to the fact that it's a $1 billion industry to make you feel crap. And actually, this is the most clever thing, because it's the most unattainable thing to be thin at all times, because it's almost impossible through changes of the body, through the aging, through pregnancies. So this means that you can constantly consume products because it's unattainable. So the more something is unattainable, the more profitable it will be. And I think, of course, that image is feeding, like, you know, so much of a large industry, up to fashion, to gym classes, to Amazon sending you mats and ways to kind of restrict the belly, and all those things are being fed out of images like this. Once you know this, again, you can take part in it. I enjoy being sportive and I enjoy feeling confident in my body. You can take a decision on how you want to be, but just be aware of why images are being put out there. But you can't stop belief system. We are born to believe, and we shape belief system nonstop as people.
So how are we, as a regular person that is bombarded with so many images, what can we do to shield ourselves from this?
I think it's less shielding, is more putting distance with it. It's the same, you know, in mental health, where a lot of the discussions are, you've said something tough to me, or I need to just be able to process that, not react straight away, and comprehend my best way to react with it. For me, like, the fact that the world will send you signals that will trigger you is something you could never avoid it, because otherwise we'll have to be on our sofas all day long and never leave the house, right? But I feel the way you respond to them is a key thing. If someone, again, comes up to you and says something rude, it's your way to respond that matters. It's not, you can't control that someone at some point is going to say something rude to you, but you can control how you're affected by it, how it's going to guide your day, how you're going to process it, how you're going to look after yourself and be kind to yourself to respond to it. I think visuals for me is the same, where they will be there. Actually, the generation of our kids is going to look at even more visuals, but training them that how to look at images, how visuals are affecting them, and therefore to put distance with them, that is not truthful at all times. It's not, especially in the rise of deepfake, for instance, it's not at all times something that they should digest, that they're allowed to put distance. In the same way that the emotions of other people, they're allowed to put distance with them. It's in that distance that you'll be able to be healthy with it, because you want to evolve in your world and you want to be filled with experiences. I adore visuals. I want to be filled with experiences of different visuals. But I think it's treating them as what they are, which is a visual that is not yours. And I think to put distance, to ultimately create your own visual environment separately, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that distance is the same where if someone shouts at you, it's more to do with them than it is to do with you. So the distance is, again, very important to comprehend that while it's affecting you, it's not everything. Mm-hmm. And I think right now we're consuming them, they become everything because we're not putting the right distance with them. But with the right distance, it's totally fine to have visuals surrounding us. I think it's just that it's teaching that distance.
Talking about teaching, how are you teaching your children to interact with images?
That's really interesting. I feel my kids are very privileged, and I think it's important to say that as a start of that conversation, because, you know, like Atlas, my eldest, I have a almost 4 years old and a 4 months old, but Atlas, my eldest, is exposed to people who make visuals all the time. So he's not just seeing a visual, he's then encountering a team of creative or an artist that will tell him how he's made that, or how she has made that visual. That changes everything, because I think the critical thinking of it, he's going to constantly be thinking that person made it or that team made it. So there's an understanding that, again, is not the truth, and that it's multiple creativity that comes together in making that visual. So I feel that exposure is incredible. I think, again, through their privileges, they're encountering different visual narratives and storytelling all day long, because they're being shifted from different visual environments all the time. Like, I'm going with one of my artists next week in Sicily with my eldest and his eldest. So they're constantly like in studios in different visual environments of the city. My job is incredible for this, because when we implement a public art projects and when we go to the studio of the artist, when we do brand collaborations, it's in such different environments all the time, in such different countries, that their breadth of understanding of the visual diversity that you can have is quite large. I think it's hard to tell how it would affect them, because they're still in the making at this stage. But it just, you know, I loved it when we did the David Attenborough documentary on Apple TV. So we did all his public art that was released a month and a half ago. And that morning it was everywhere on the press. And there was specifically that public art image of a big dinosaur, because it's on a dinosaur, it's called Planets. And it's all biodegradable painting. It's on 40 meters, what our artist did, David Popa, for it. And it was on the Metro paper. And I just ripped off the image, and Atlas went off to school with it. And the teacher sent me the funniest picture 2 hours from that, where he was standing. You will swear he had led the whole project. He had so much confidence next to that picture, and was explaining to the other kids how this was made. And then that evening, the artist dropped by at the house with my two colleagues. And, you know, Atlas interacted with him on, he thought actually they were quite small, because, which is an interesting comment, because for him, the dinosaurs look really small in that image when they're obviously 40 meters long. But that's actually a really good awareness of scale, and the fact that there's a, you know, there's a very big difference on the way you look at an image versus with it scaled, right? But I feel therefore he's so lucky because he's able to hold that little image, to make sense of it, to explain it, and to ask questions furthering to it with people who have answers, not all the answers, but some answers. So I'm curious to see how he's going to approach the world through that. But therefore the hope is that he has that critical thinking, and that he's able to better and better ask questions about it.
It's so interesting because it's, as growing up and just seeing the behind the scenes of it, like my family were all musicians. So it's the understanding of what goes on, like behind the stage, the training that requires to produce something that, you know, just looks so elegant and so simple. And the same with images, where you see something, you know, even scrolling through Instagram and you see it for like a split second, but actually how much work has gone into it. And, you know, what are the values of the artist who conceptualized it? And then, you know, if it's a sculpture or, you know, something very intricate that requires not just one individual to put that together, there's whole teams behind it. And just understanding it from a completely different perspective rather than just like the final, like the result, and that's still just all you see.
Which I hope people will be able to see more and more, because, I mean, we have to, again, with deepfake and AI, going to who created the image is going to be really important. We have to really put in place a check-in process on how an image is made, because it obviously tells a very different story, whether it's real or whether it's fake. It also tells a very different story on where it's displayed. And I think it's going to be really essential that we ask those questions. But I think, going back to my kids, yes, I think they're so lucky because they are in that reflection anyway. And their dad is in tech. He was one of the youngest VC in Europe in the B2B tech sector, and for his own VC. And I feel he's there, therefore, he'll be much more scientific and technologically led, therefore. So I feel something I've always loved about our kids is the fact that the questioning that we would have towards life is going to be almost completely opposite, but therefore very complementary. Mm-hmm. We definitely don't ask the same questions as a couple, as a relationship, towards the world. And I think that's, I hope, would enable them to just have different questions in stock when they encounter a situation.
Mm. I'm going to come back on the deepfake and AI, because I think that's a really interesting conversation. But just going back to your kids, and obviously them seeing the behind the scenes of art and what's going on, and you being so, you know, passionate and, you know, deeply involved in the space, I'm just curious what your parenting approach is when it comes to encouraging your kids to do or make art.
I think for me, like, being a parent was essential and very important. So I think I've been with Will for 9 years now, and for being parent first was like always gonna be the plan. It's something that we thought deeply about it. So therefore my parenting approach is like a 15-year-old reflection. It's like something that I've always wanted, but I therefore wanted to make sure that this was enabling another human being to be really empowered in terms of the life that they would take on. I think it became, as the two businesses, the businesses of my husband and I, started doing really well, it was also, how do we empower them to be them? You know, shield it away from ultimately what their parents are doing. And I feel the, and shield is probably the wrong word, I think it's more, for them to find really what they care about beyond what we must love. So I think empowerment for me is really important. First of all, I feel there's a great book by one of my girlfriends, Mary Gentles, who did Gentle Empowerment, Gentle Guidance. It's called Gentle Guidance, but it's about empowerment of kids. And she got an OB for the way she was empowering kids as a teacher, as a head teacher, and then went on to publish a book. And I think the values she described is very much the values I have. So for me, it was always about, how do I get those kids to be confident and take on the world and have that muscle of resilience, muscle of imagination, muscle of interacting with people and asking the right questions. And I think absolutely the world is theirs, because they come from foundations of a family that love each other, that's very stable, and that is able to provide, therefore, the different opportunities on whoever they decide to become. So I think for me, their kindness, their empathy, their imagination, their resilience, their confidence was going to be the key component of what I had to pass on, because the rest I felt confident I could provide. So I think art was not really I think art is not really like a key pillar in a sense. I think visual is, like making sure that he's visually curious in the same way that he's, you know, music-wise, he also has that curiosity, that he has a curiosity towards math and books and developing all types of curiosities that are at the heart of it. I think, you know, in a sense, like I never took mat leave for both. So like they are so exposed to what I do that I'm really not that stressed about them not being familiar with the art world. But I care a lot less about that. I'm more thinking, I just hope this gives them the curiosity of finding out what they love. And now, if it is art, then fantastic. If it isn't art, I couldn't care less. As a person, I think the joy we both get as a couple is to do what we love on a daily basis. So my priority is for them to find that. It's not to find some kind of truth in the art world, is to find, as Atlas or Vivaldi, what do they want to become? Mm-hmm. And I will be so excited to discover that with them. So even the education system we went for in Brisbane, Gianni Manuel is bilingual and very creativity led. So that enables them hopefully to be less about achievements and more about what they love to learn, and then ultimately find that. So I think all our principles is more around this. Now, of course, they're exposed, you know, I frame his little drawings next to the artworks we've collected over the past 10 years, and I do it on purpose. I don't frame all the drawings, but I go through a curation with him, and he's very proud. Like, his drawings are next to the artworks, nicely framed, nicely hung, and I want his confidence to feel his visual expression is taken into an account into a house that's literally filled by art. Mm-hmm. But it's again more confidence discussion than it is an artistic discussion. I would never want him to feel he can't express himself. I mean, so far it really doesn't seem that it's going to be the problem, because Atlas has got an enormous amount of confidence and he's expressing himself very well. But just in case, I've always been quite careful that we are strong personalities. We know what we want, both as parents. There needs to be a lot of room for those kids, and their expressions is going to be as valued by everybody else who walks into this house, especially in the context of most people walks into this house are very confident and very expressive. Mm. That's more the way I look at them.
Mm. I mean, I'm on board with what you're saying in terms of giving the space to allow them to choose what their personal interests are and also what they've naturally good at. It got me also thinking about this article that was talking about how creative art forms, so not just the visual arts, but music, have kind of been not necessarily dying out, but the idea of it being not being a hobby that you just stay with for the rest of your life, that's something that actually enriches you and makes you happy and joyful, that it doesn't have to be a career. It doesn't mean that, you know, if you decide to go into the corporate world, that all of a sudden you're like, okay, well, this is not for me. But having that as part of your life is exceptionally enriching. And actually, a lot of people are missing out by not having that in their lives. And I feel like from my own personal journey, that's exactly what happened, because I was like, okay, I'll just do this as a hobby. And then I just never did, because I never found time for it. But I do absolutely miss that. And just being able, as you said, to express yourself and find a format, a way to get your ideas and thoughts out that are not words, because it's another language, like the visual, the music, it's another language. It's another way to communicate. So I find that fascinating.
There's a great book that just came out by one of my friend, Albert Reed, who's the MD of Common Nurse, and he just published The Muscle of Imagination. And we just sat next to each other at dinner. We actually about to see each other for lunch again, because I feel the two of us sat and I was like, oh my God, you just are literally capturing everything I believe in into one book. And then I read the book and I was so happy. I sent him a long bullet point email of all the things I loved about the book. But it just, I'm a big believer in the space for imagination again. So it's about creating space too. The fact that hobbies are dying, I think, is problematic. You should have hobbies that are beyond your job. Like, I have random hobbies from cycling to baking to, like, you know, I love dressing up a table, all this Vegas, that are not related to my job. And I feel that's a space for imagination, a space for creativity. And I think the happiest moments that I have watching my kids is when they have that imagination space, you know, when they speak to themselves and they come up with those stories and they are so occupied in it, so busy in their own imagination. And the muscle of imagination speaks about the need of it and the fact that we have all those tools that are trying to take away those precious moments for our imagination and our creativity. And there's obviously all those apps that are trying to battle for our attention. It's literally our attention is worth billion right now. But I think that attention in making sure that we leave it also to imagination and creativity, and however we do it, whether it's baking or walking, that we get that bits of imagination. But that is so key, because that reflection is enabling us, first of all, to feel happy and mental health ways to be much better, but also to be so much more creative. So it's if Atlas is busy imagining something, I would never stop it. Even if it technically should be eating at that point, I would always move slightly and be flexible, because I think that space is so precious in a time where every single technological tool is going to battle for his time and his eyes ball. I want him to have that space. So I just would never impose a routine if he's in that space. Obviously, you know, he still has to sleep and eat and do all these things, but I feel like that's going to be a big battle again for that generation of kids, where everything is done to grab their attention, but the doing nothing, being bored, coming up with ideas is so essential to us being creative beings and being happy on the back of that I want to protect it as much as I can. And that's the reason I'm not a hardcore routine person when I see he's in that space.
It's so true. It's having that quiet reflection time to yourself. I mean, some people meditate, some people read books, but just having a moment of time that you dedicate to a hobby that doesn't require too much thinking. It's just being present and maybe being busy, but not so busy that it requires for you to achieve or attain a goal. You're just sort of in the moment, in the present. And I think we spend so much time in front of screens and being bombarded with things that we don't actually focus on ourselves and things coming from the inside out, as opposed to just absorbing things from the outside in.
Yeah, and the achievement, in a sense, we are both demonstration as parents of people who never think of achievements but have achieved a lot, in a sense that, like, this is the reason why I'm so scared of the school system in the UK, because every school I walked into was telling me they record breaking numbers to get into Cambridge and Oxford when my kid was 3. And I was just like, I just find that so scary, because I don't care what Achievement Atlas does, but I really do care that as a human being, he's developing happily and confidently. And it's, I really don't believe in that relationship with achievement or objective. I think it's something that makes us miserable to attain to objective and hang on to the idea that might make us happy, rather than enjoying the process and doing something that we love. And then, of course, there's so many milestones that will come with it. But the relationship to achievement is something that I just really don't believe in. I just don't think it's healthy.
I don't either. I totally, totally, 100% support you on that. Going back to deepfakes, AI.
Yes.
And I mean, the speed at which technology is moving, do you think AI is destroying creatives and creativity?
So I have tons of artists who use AI, and I actually have a very special story by our artist Ellie Pritz, who sadly has a health condition that means she cannot paint anymore. So she used AI to further her vision, and it is really Ellie's. You couldn't come up with it, because the way she dictates the brief. And if you think of Damien Hirst, that never really made his work. It was always studios that were making the works. The way she's kind of directing the vision is very artistic. So I'm never scared on how creatives can take on new tools, because they are always a way able to expand the creativity of it. I think the problem with AI, as we know, is maybe you've seen that court case in the last few weeks where a lawyer in the States asked ChatGPT to write the case, but didn't check. And, you know, the ChatGPT, although the argument look incredibly immaculately put together, you will swear this was to allege it, the cases were invented of reference. Because probably in the brief, they hadn't said must be actual cases that had happened, right? That is very scary, because the way it's formatted, it looks like a true information. Deepfakes and AI pose the same problems with images, where they will more and more be images and you see it even with protests, where you can already invent a story. Like right now, there's loads of protests in France. You can make it look much more dramatic than it is. You can zoom in with the bin that just really exploded with fire and make it sound like the entire France on fire, which is going to have a rip-off that's disastrous, because people are going to think the conflict is much deeper when it really isn't. Of course, it's terrible what's happening, but the protests are actually quite small in comparison to the scale that's taking on TikTok and on social media. Deepfake is one layer further than that, where you're inventing a story, you're inventing the reality. Now, there's nothing wrong with inventing realities. We've always done it. We go to movies we love and we read fiction books because we love a new reality to make us reflect on our own. However, when you do know it's fiction, that's a problem. So, you know, the fact that Harry Potter sold so many books is because it was the biggest escape of all time for those kids. And they were able to relate in their own realities with that book in hand. But not knowing it's fiction, again, is dangerous because, you know, here in this book, magic doesn't happen in reality. I think the problem, again, is like you need a toolkit to know those images are fake. But I have no issue with fiction. I'm comfortable being in and out of a fiction and nonfiction world. I'm just not comfortable in having blurred limits that are not defined, where no one is informed this would be the case. And I will be thinking, you know, you have done X. And I think also deepfakes were invented by the porn sector. And there's a reason for that, is that you could invent sexuality for someone. You could destroy so many lives in the process of it. And we know how amazing it is through social media that we can reach many people, but also how soul-destroying it is at times that you can have people inventing a reality against you. Deepfake is a furthering of this. And the fact that the porn sector was a creator of it is not reassuring, because it shows how it could be used against people to create things that have never existed.
I didn't know that.
That the porn sector created it.
Yes.
I actually talk about it in my book. So I had to go down onto deep research of how visuals were created. So my brain is full of random anecdotes and studies, thanks to having writing it. I didn't know that before I discovered it either. But I think it makes a lot of sense, because obviously the initial first scandals were very much people pasting a face onto acts. And that's, and, you know, like sex and scandals go hand in hand. People love a sex scandal. So actually the porn industry is very innovative as a sector, believe it or not, and which makes sense because it's a very large sector. It's 1/10 of the internet in terms of content, which is huge. So you can imagine that they have innovated substantially, but they have created deepfake as a result.
Wow. That's interesting how so much of our, you know, it's a lot of things spilling over from the porn culture that we're not even aware of, and how it infiltrates sort of the rest of the normal kind of world and society. What surprised you most about the art world?
I was too young to have preconception and I never came from it. The thing I would want to change is definitely a stronger meritocracy, a stronger time diversity, a stronger access to it. And I would love the artists to be the spokespeople of our generation more than the silos that tells a few stories to a few people. But actually, how amazing would it be that artists are very essential to society and end up being the spokespeople to our generation in that sense.
Mm. Thank you so much for coming onto the show, Maureen. It's like so fascinating talking to you, and I have so many questions for you. So I think we should do a part two for when your book is published, which is coming out next year in March.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited for that. But
thank you so much.
Fascinating chat. And thank you so much.
My total pleasure. Thank you for having me. Thank you for your great questions.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me here on Anatomy of a Leader. What were your takeaways? And if you haven't already, I'd love for you to subscribe and follow this podcast. And I'll see you in the next episode.